Hello, everyone. I am Jessica Saxton, the Environmental Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and the host of Living Downstream. Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Mulala, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer, and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute.
Today we have Chrisette Palencius joining us, a local resident discussing the impact of white supremacy on land use and forestry management. Chrisette does not speak for any organization. She does not speak for anyone, and this is her personal opinion. So thank you for joining us, and it's great to have you on this episode of Living Downstream. Could you tell us a bit about yourself and what you do?
Hi, everyone. My name is Chrisette. My father is from the Turtle Clan of Kahnawake, and I live here in Oregon. I am 42 this year, and I'm happy to be here. I hope you're all healthy, and it's a beautiful rainy day today. I like to use this introduction, use my language whenever I can, because our languages hold so much intrinsic wisdom and beauty and knowledge within the words. And my grandmother was a fluent speaker, but my dad didn't learn the language. So I'm trying to, I spent a lot of time every week trying to learn the language. And I've learned so much more than just words by learning it. And I just want to let you know, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for being open to having this conversation with me. I am a birth worker, doula. I'm kind of new, just been doing that a couple years. Started doing that because I realized that there's so much inequity in maternal and infant health here in this country. In fact, there's a growing maternal health crisis. So your grandmother or your mother is more, you know, you are more likely to die from childbirth related causes than your mother or your grandmother here in this country. And by doing this work, I've also come to realize that I have my own birth trauma that I am healing from. And so really excited about doing this work and hope to disrupt a system that causes harm for Black and Indigenous birthing people. I'm also an herbalist. I grow a lot of the medicines that I use in my small business called Urbanhood, and kind of a community organizer, a water protector. I'm a mother for a wonderful young man named Gabriel. And like I said, learning my language, Kanyangeha or Mohawk language. Somewhat of a matriarch here within my family and community. Really a connector. I really like being a person who helps fuse bonds between people and community, and kind of a farmer. I don't know exactly if other people would consider me a farmer, but I'm a farmer / permaculturalist, herbalist. Try to meditate. I'm a daughter of an Iraqi immigrant who was born in Baghdad. And my father his family comes from the Mohawk community of Kahnawake near Montreal. And I do some other things.
Thank you for that introduction. You have such a vast history and culture, it seems like. That's very incredible.
Thank you. Yeah, growing up, I didn't think that there was anybody other than my siblings who had this like unique mix. And as I'm learning and connecting with more people, I'm like, oh wow, there are other people who are Middle Eastern and natives. So I guess I'm lucky in that way.
So if people do speak the native language or your language, do you find it appreciative or respectful for them to address you using that language rather than English?
Oh, absolutely. These languages were given to these people for the purposes of living, communicating. And so I honestly, I wish we all could speak the languages that were here forever. And if you think about it, it's almost disrespectful to speak this language that was imposed. This language that I'm speaking is disrespectful. But it's what I have. Like, it's my primary language. And I do speak Spanish, and I'm learning Kanyangeha. And it's kind of like what the best that I have right now. It's the best that we most of us have right now, but it's definitely not, there's a lot to be desired within the language. Like, there's a lot of words that don't have deep meaning. Like, the language doesn't seem to have deep meaning. And I heard once, I don't remember where it was, but they were saying, and they were speaking, I think, about a Salish language, that you use this language to caress and you use English to like cut, to harm someone. So it's kind of interesting, just like what is built into the words. And I'll use an example, like the word for love, like I love you, konorunqua, has the word for precious in it. And it also happens to be very similar to the word for water. So of course we're gonna be water protectors. Of course we're gonna value that entity, that resource. I don't want to say the word resource, but you know what I mean? Like, it's built into the language, our values. So I love hearing people speak their native languages, and I'll talk about it more later, about the importance and the connection between language revitalization and retention and biodiversity.
Thank you. That was a great answer. I personally speak Spanish, and it's been a long struggle, but I feel like I can speak it fluently now and comfortable. I try to
Awesome.
use it as much as possible when I am with Hispanics and with Latinx, but it's absolutely beautiful. I can't get over different languages and how beautiful they are. And like you said, the meaning behind the words, I don't feel that with English. It almost feels like surface, like it's surface. And I would love to learn more about your language and the importance of it. My question for you, because you do speak Spanish, is it difficult compared to learning Spanish?
Yeah, I don't know, because I learned Spanish pretty young, because I lived in a community that was predominantly Spanish speaking. And culturally, like, I have a blended family, so there's a lot of usage of that language in just day-to-day life. I'm definitely not fluent, but I can get by, definitely. If people don't talk to me, or they talk to me for a short period of time, they might think I'm fluent, that kind of Spanish. But yeah, learning my language has been extremely difficult. And then there's a whole nother piece of, Spanish is so available. Like, there's so much content. You can have totally Spanish radio stations and TV channels and movies. And there's a lot of people that speak that language. But it's not from this continent. It's from a different continent. So there's something else about having a language from this continent, and another additional layer of having a language that was spoken by my ancestors. And it can get emotional too, just feeling like, why is it so hard for me to learn this language? And why didn't I get to learn it growing up? Like, there has been times when I just kind of cry just trying to learn the language. And it doesn't, like, Spanish for me doesn't have that emotional connection or that like strong desire, like, and also this urgency of feeling like we need to protect this language and preserve it before it's lost, because there aren't many native language speakers left in my community. Now there's this really wonderful phenomenon where there's fluent language youth and children, because they are prioritizing keeping it alive. And luckily there's a lot of resources, and especially after COVID, I was able to my community, my home community, is on the West Coast. I mean the East Coast, and I'm here on the West Coast. So that's another barrier. But with COVID, they opened up a lot of, like, online learning opportunities. So I'm very grateful and lucky to have the opportunity to learn from being away, and just remember that, like, there's so many other communities that don't have their language anymore, and just how devastating and upsetting and, like, frustrating that is, because once there's so much loss that goes along with the loss of language and words. So it's cool. Like, my son actually knows more words than my dad did. So I have high hopes that we're gonna be able to keep our language alive. And there's so many younger people that are prioritizing it.
How did your son become more fluent and knowledgeable
Oh,
than
he's not fluent, and I'm not fluent, but he, just from me talking to him, just, like, using everyday words. And he's so funny. He'll, like, he'll learn a word, and then just the way his mind works, he'll make a joke, like, quis quis means pig. And then he calls me, he call doesn't call me it all the time, but he makes jokes. He called me quis quisette. So it's fun to, like, just incorporate whenever I can, just, like, try to use, like, words with him. Not a lot. Like, I definitely would like to be able to do it more, and I would love for him to take classes with me, but it's just different. I think that the way that some of the elders who weren't raised on the reserve or reservation, sometimes just were made to feel that it wasn't as valuable. And that's part of just the ongoing systemic oppression and disregard of cultural practices and language. But yeah, we are trying to change that.
Thank you. So, jumping back into the questions, you kind of wear a lot of different hats. You do a lot of different things. So, what specifically inspired you to talk about the topics we're talking about today and, be here with us and advocate? What inspired you down this path?
Yeah, well, part of it is, I think, just the fact that I do come from a long line of people that lived in balance with the land. Just like I said, despite centuries of violent attempts to extinguish that, we are lucky that we have retained our teachings to a big degree. As I'm learning more about kind of the cultural ceremonial practices, and we have You might have heard of it, the Ohandukari Wadekwa, also known as the Thanksgiving address, or the words before all else. And that is done before every important event, and sometimes every day. I try to do it every day. And that's where we acknowledge and appreciate all of our relatives, our human and non-human relatives. And it can take some time. And then if we have time, I'm happy to do it. And I was raised with some values, like considering 7 generations from now, like what will our actions, how will that affect the generations to come? So we have to keep those people in mind as well. My dad, being an environmentalist, I ended up kind of following suit, and I minored in environmental studies. And I lived in Olympia, Washington for a while, and that community, there's like the Evergreen State College there. And that community kind of really attracted a bunch of people who were kind of thinking in ways that inspired me, for example, like gardening, mushroom growing. So I got to connect with different people, like people like Paul Stamets. Like I didn't necessarily learn from him, but that was like a big attraction to people. And Heather Flores, who wrote the book Food Not Lawns. And then I was able to mentor with Rowan White, learning from Steve McCumber. I got to do a training with Wisdom of the Elders and an apprenticeship of traditional ecological knowledge. So a lot of different things like that. I was lucky to have like come across my path. A lot of it was virtual, and some of it was in person. And then I got to go to Standing Rock, where I got to participate in a decolonial abolitionist life, like for a short time, and see what that was like. And simultaneously, there was the attempts of ecocide by a fascist and illegitimate government. So just being in the midst of all of that. And then I was able to go to Mauna Kea in Hawaii, where they're protecting their sacred mountain, which is the tallest mountain in the world from base to peak. And that was an incredible experience as well. There was actually some people, well, a few of us who had been to both Standing Rock. I'll say many, many people have been to both Standing Rock and Mauna Kea. Both were grounded in ceremonial practices, ecological restoration. We went and planted hundreds of trees while we were there. Education, they had daily workshops, a medical clinic, and despite all that, there was still this constant threat of removal and arrest by 9 different enforcement agencies. But so much beauty and joy as well, and intergenerational beauty and joy. And recently, I got to see Jameiko Osorio, a Kanaka scholar who came to Oregon and witnessed such a powerful and beautiful account of the time there and the relationship between land and culture and language. So those are some of the things. And then, like I said, so many hours of Zoom and podcasts is like a way that I continue to learn to and participating in the Black radical struggle for liberation, being at Black Lives Matter events, both in Portland. I went to the CHOP and the CHAZ, if you remember that. That was where there was, let's say, a couple city blocks kind of reclaimed, and different protests in Portland. And there's a quote that I heard Jamaica Osorio say was, "Decolonization requires abolition, and Black liberation requires decolonial practice." So that's something that has that concept has kind of guided my work of how to be in community, how to be a good relative. And then a little bit of work and focus on the Palestinian occupation and Israeli apartheid. But I want to be and transparent about my involvement in systems of oppression. So just by nature of being alive here and having the privileges that I do, living on land that the original people were forced off of with the threat of death. And I lived for a time with a partner who was a cattle rancher, and I saw the damages associated with that. So there's so many things that I'm still sorting out. So I don't believe that I'm superior in any way. Just here to share my thoughts and recognize that we all are on this journey together.
Thank you. I find it really interesting that you think 7 generations ahead and consider like the impacts and the outcomes. When I talk with others, it seems like we don't look past our next generation or even past ours. And it's devastating because trying to talk to someone about the climate or environment or any kind of topics like that, I look very far ahead, and I want generations to come to be able to look at the land and look at the culture and appreciate it and have respect. But I also struggle to see how we're going to get there.
Well, I'm glad that you're doing that. I wonder how you came to be like that.
I honestly don't know. I do have 3 Native American cousins who were adopted, and I've learned a lot from them, and I learned so much about the culture, and I had more of an appreciation for it. But yes, I am very different. I think my childhood and my upbringing led me to my environmentalist views now. I'm LGBTQ plus, I'm an environmentalist, I'm very focused on generations to come, and kind of cool to talk to someone else that also thinks that way. Since we're talking about language and land and culture, I kind of want to focus on the statement land back, language back, and culture back. So I've heard this from time to time. Could you explain what this means and how we could go forward incorporating this more?
Yeah, so the way I see that statement, like we hear more land back than the following language back and culture back. But the way I see it is it's a very clear call to what we want and need. Many people are realizing that reconciliation conversations and education attempts aren't as helpful in this moment. And they definitely have been attempted. But our access to the land we were put here to steward is not something that can be delayed any longer. It seems like every week I hear of a land back headline, and that's wonderful. But I do want to be clear that it's not enough. There's been so much damage. So we need language back and culture back simultaneously, because land back is just the start. And I think that if it doesn't come with those other two, then we may fall short on our ability to do what we need to do with that land. So it's a three-pronged attempt, I would say. It needs to be anyway. And we need to definitely be funding that. And there needs to be one, recognition, and then two, like attempts to remedy the situation. And we don't have a choice. We're reaching climate chaos and just times where we can't enjoy and thrive just being alive here on this earth.
Do you think having this three-pronged approach and, pushing for this, do you think it will have an impact on our views on climate change and hopefully encourage a spark towards more of a movement to address it?
Yeah, I think that, and I believe that people will realize that we just don't have a choice. There's no question that the land is suffering under this illegal occupation of European settlers. The ethical option is also the logical one, and we want to live and thrive in order to reverse the trends of hotter, more frequent fires, which is just one symptom of a white supremacist fascist rule. So we must quickly redistribute the land to the original people. And I also want to point out that connection between healing the land and healing our bodies. There's so many cultural items and food that are fire dependent. And there's, on the flip side, there's so many extractive programs and projects that are harmful not only for our bodies, but the people that are involved with it, the people that are employed by doing that. And we see this phenomenon where, when there's an extractive project, we also see that the women and relatives in those near those communities are also getting murdered. And so you might have heard of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, or MMIW, or MMIR for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives, to include people of all genders. And so there's just this really close connection between what we're doing with the land, what is happening on the land, and what is happening with our health and our bodies and our safety.
I think it's interesting to note that I don't see as much public coverage and news coverage for natives who are impacted by that, like you were explaining. It seems like when someone else goes missing, there's a lot of coverage very quickly, yet it might be weeks before I see anything. So it's very disheartening. It's just really sad. I feel like everyone should get equal coverage, or more so to people who have been oppressed in history.
Yeah, your note, what you're noticing is absolutely correct.
Yeah. You mentioned wildfires in Oregon. As many know, we do have more intense wildfires in the last few years, and Indigenous people are known for having safe and well-managed forests. Do you think there would be a way for us to work together to create better management practices that could help prevent these intense fires?
Yeah, I have seen, in fact, Umpqua Watersheds was involved with a work with the Native Women's Chair, which is an organization working on restoration and land back not too far from here. So things like that are super important. I think that there's just so much more intention and efforts that need to happen, but with white supremacy, it kind of gets disregarded any work that isn't done by one, a white person, and hopefully it's a white male. So I think that we need to kind of decolonize the way that we think about all of these things. And like, there's been science happening for time immemorial here. Science is like observing, and that is being in outside in nature. Observing is what people have always done everywhere. But on this land, which we're speaking about, this continent, of course, there's going to be evidence. Like, you can't call it anything but evidence of just like how to live in balance. It was kind of all thrown out at one point, where you have kind of almost militaristic attempts to prevent and suppress fires, which was a cultural practice. And now we're seeing within the last, I've only lived here for like 10, 11 years, and already I've seen how much more extreme the fire risks are. So it's happening quickly. So But we also need to move really quickly to this restoration and transfer of land and power.
Thank you. By acknowledging our colonial background and the impacts of Manifest Destiny on culture and land, do you think we'll be able to make progress towards healthier forests and lands in the future?
Yeah, I think we like I said, we just don't have a choice. We have to do it. But there's a lot of risk. You know, we hear about states preventing education on just history. And like it's just such a cultural thing. Like for here in where I live in a county that's named after a fascist. I live in a state that was intended to be a whites only state. I live in a city that was named after a man, Aaron Rose, who was given, I want to say 150 acres just because he's a white man. And then you have Roseburg Forest Products, who is a huge landowner controlling you know, basically what we experience, controlling our ecosystem really, for profit. So it's a lot that we're up against. I'm live like, you know, my son went to school at Roseburg High School, which has a racist mascot and has refused to change. There's Joseph Lane Middle School, and what's the other one called? Everything is named after racist, fascist, Indian killers, slave enslavers. That is clearly like what the values are by the dominant culture, and despite their claims otherwise, like. There's no hiding it. You are name, like, look at your name. Like,
And that can definitely
so,
be seen with the mascot because that was a long, hard fought battle. And if I recall, nothing changed, right?
yes, I was involved along with some people who became good friends of mine to try and change that because. Native youth are dying at suicide is the second suicide is the second leading cause of death for Native youth. And there was a study that was done to link the fact that racist mascots have an impact on suicide rates. And school is hard enough. Just any kid is having, you know, a hard enough time. But just to have additional oppression and additional things like that in your face every day is just so unnecessary. So I don't understand. Like there was legislation to prevent that, but there's loopholes. So that's what we're still dealing with here in the year 2023.
Yeah, unfortunately, I let's
There was one
see.
person on the school board who decided that they were going to prevent the change. Charles Lee, who's a lawyer, and shouldn't be practicing law if you're gonna go against evidence that shows that it's harmful to our students. Really, I feel has no business being in that position. But also just the fact that the rest of I don't want to say everybody because there was some strong support, but it should never have been a question where it was the community was brought in because we know what the community thinks. We know where they're at. And that's not their job isn't to make these decisions. It should be the job of the people put there to have the best interests of their students. And the public was brought in, and of course they were saying awful, racist, hurtful, like it was very re-traumatizing. It was a very re-traumatizing time to spend in that auditorium at Roseburg High School, like so many hours. I don't know. That's not the topic right now, but it's related.
Ecosystems need to be engaged both naturally and humanely. We need to acknowledge racism, bigotry, and disconnectivity together. So personally, I seek comfort in nature. It helps me feel grounded and connected. I use it as my decompression method and when I'm struggling with mental health. Without it, I would feel completely lost. And since moving into the city, it's become even more difficult to connect with nature. And taking a drive out, 20 or 30 minutes to connect, it almost feels wrong, driving there. I typically try to find a place that I can walk to, but being in the city, it's very urban and there's noise and I can't hear the nature around me. And so personally, I would struggle without that connection. Do you have this connection with nature, and do you fear that you may lose it if we continue down the path we're on currently?
Yeah, I mean, there's always been this intimate connection, and it's only been within the last, I don't know, a couple hundred years that people have been so removed from the land. And there's people that have never stepped foot on the earth with their feet, with their bare feet, you know? There's just such a disconnection, where we're just in this weird lifestyle, right? That we're indoors, just like focused on other things, and part of that is capitalism. But I mean, a lot of that is capitalism, but there's just so much lost, right? Like, I just get so much joy from, like, right now we're approaching springtime and just being engaged in what's going on. I think it was Heather Flores said that there's always good news in the garden, and so sometimes we just need some good news. Right now, there's I think it's called a rose, Daphne odorata, which is one of my favorite plants that's blooming, and it just smells amazing. And it's right outside where I just went to the doctor at Evergreen. It was the second floor of urgent care. Anyway, they have a Daphne blooming right now, and it's only going to be blooming for a little bit. So, like, these little things just bring us so much joy, and there's so much teachings, like, within my culture that tells us what to do when that's nature and season based. So, and yeah, as a farmer and a food grower, I am lucky that I am more engaged in these changes and these events. And I was really fortunate to be able to receive. I applied for this program when I was living in Olympia, called the Kitchen Garden Project with the Grub, and they came and built me three raised beds with soil, and they gave me seeds, and they also provided workshops to learn how to grow food. So that was kind of like a big turning point in my life. And then when I moved here, I replicated the program with a nonprofit that I was working for, that I no longer work for. But then it transferred to UC Veg, called Community Veg Education Group. So all that I have gained from that, I want to make available to other people, because it was truly transformational. Like, I did my three beds and I was gardening in there, and then I was like, I could garden outside of those three beds. And so it became this point where every inch of the where I was renting, I just planted and planted and planted. And then I was like, oh, I could put stuff on the roof too. So I put pots on the roof, and then I moved. And then I started like taking over this vacant kind of lot that was down the street for me, and it became a community garden. And it was just beautiful and like very, very transformational for me. And But also difficult because I didn't have a stable place where I could live for, multiple seasons, which is sometimes required. Like I would plant an apple tree and then have to move. Like one year I moved, like I think like six times, which was tough. So all of that energy that I wanted to cultivate just kind of didn't go anywhere. And sometimes I would go by somewhere that I had poured in so much love and seeded that was just kind of plowed over and grass seed. So that was hard. So I'm really grateful now that I have land that I hopefully will be able to steward for many years to come. And I'll tell that story because it's really empowering, just not just for me, but for everybody that gets to benefit from just the fact that one person in the community has stable land. It can benefit so many people. So when I moved here and I got a grant to help purchase home with the IDA program, and it's a state program that helps low-income people build assets. So I was able to purchase a home, and it was just kind of like what I could afford wasn't much. So it was all kind of tore up, and there was nothing really growing, kind of a dirt patch. And then I started doing what I needed to do right away. I was like, before I even unpacked boxes, I was like planting trees and building the soil. And then I noticed that the pollinators were coming, and that was really exciting. And then I saw like small animals coming. And then within the last couple of years, there's like deer that have found this place, and they come here for like surprisingly, because where I'm located, you wouldn't think that deer would come, but they come and they are telling their friends. And then there's birds of prey, and I can see that what I can do to transform and heal the land. And there's like worms that are just so happy. Like you can just move the soil and pick up a bunch of worms. So I know that we can do this, and I know that I can do this, and I would love someday to be able to do it on a larger scale, like what Native Women Share is doing down south. So we can do it. We're doing it.
I agree. I think all of us doing it on our own, we do add up. Yes.
And I wanted to say too, like about mental health, it's been scientifically proven, not that we necessarily need scientists to validate what we already know, but microbes getting stirred up in the soil can stimulate serotonin production, which can help you feel relaxed and happier. And then, like being in water, like that hydrotherapy is so powerful. And I live like just a couple minutes walk from the river. And I should be able to just go and enjoy that, but it's unfortunately not clean. Like people don't even want their dogs to drink from it. And so part of that really upsets me that this river has been contaminated to the point where people can't, and people have always lived near rivers. And then just the way that we don't value it is just so disgusting and upsetting. So I also think about like who gets to have these important connections, and like people that are very privileged, they get to go and fly to vacations, they go to Hawaii or different places. But in Hawaii, even the people that live there, they're telling people, we don't want tourists, we don't want you to come, they're not invited. And on that island, there's more natives living on the continent than actually in their homeland, because there's so many tourists, it's changed the ability for them to just be able to afford to live. So there's like 30 to 1 tourists to Native Hawaiians. And then we think about like the land ownership on this, and where we live, it's about 96 to 98% of the land is owned by white people and people who didn't come from this continent. And but they're controlling and managing most of the land with no deep understanding or roots or vision, like we're talking about that seven generation. So that's a problem, and we're seeing how devastating that is.
It's very short-term sighted. Yeah. White supremacy and nationalism creates a system in which whites are privileged and receive comfort, land, money, and services and more, while others are oppressed. Would you talk a little bit about this and the impact this might have on the environment, in your opinion?
Yeah, I feel like it's an illness. Well, people don't want to have more than others. Right. There's so much emphasis on material wealth and working hard to uphold the values of capitalism. So it's sick. I see the correlation between these ways of thinking of the earth as a resource to be exploited and the way that people treat those who are more easily oppressed, like I kind of mentioned, the MMIW and MMIR. So it's a cultural value. And I once saw a map linking Indigenous language retention and revitalization and the connection of biodiversity. And I can share that link if you're interested in seeing that. So like I said, we should be learning these indigenous languages that were spoken here before colonization, before the war on the people who lived here. Before the methods of genocide, such as boarding schools, which turned into the child welfare program and termination, sterilization, forced assimilation, and Christianization. So, yeah, there should be attempts to recognize the value of those who are culture keepers and speakers, like funding immersion schools, freedom schools, culture camps, land remediation, traditional ecological knowledge, and whatnot, because the traditional practices were criminalized until like the 70s. So like I think it was, yeah, Jimmy Carter signed the American Religious Freedom Act. And then that was in 78, so just a few years before I was born. But now we're talking about, or we're looking at potentially losing ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act. And that's up against, that's in front of the Supreme Court right now. So we're going to hear in the summer what they decide, whether they decide that children can be, Native children can be taken away from their families and put into non-Native homes. And which will also undermine all of tribal sovereignty. So there's that. And then like I know you mentioned how important your cousins, I think you said their cousins, culture was to them and how much you benefited from that knowledge as well. So it's super important that children remain with their cultures and their families. And as a birth worker, I am learning so much more about that.
The law that's being tested right now at the Supreme Court that we'll hear about in the summer, does it currently protect them to be placed with the same rather than going into a white or other colored household? Okay.
Yes, that is the idea. It doesn't always happen that way, but there are protections in place that they'll go out and see if there are any family members, if there's anybody, any tribal members. It's not perfect. It's not a perfect system, but it's much better than just like a wholesale removal of Native children from their communities, which of course will sever relationships, cultural ties, language. And all of this deep, all these deep treasures that have been retained despite the attempts to like extinguish, such as like cultural fires. Yeah, I think about Smokey the Bear. I don't know how old you are, but do you know who Smokey the Bear is?
Oh, yeah.
Smokey the Bear was one of the government's attempts to prevent our cultural burns. And I didn't know that until recently, but it was like one of the longest going PSAs and of like fire suppression. And it definitely was not, it didn't help. And it kind of criminalized the cultural burn practices. So we need to reconsider all of that stuff.
I did grow up with Smokey the Bear, and as a child, I thought, oh, it's really cool, Smokey the Bear. And then I got into college and I started taking classes and became more educated, and I realized he wasn't what I thought, and all of this campaign was very destructive to the land. And it has impacted us so many years past when we started this Smokey the Bear. And I was just totally like awestruck, like not in a good way. And I can't believe we still have Smokey the Bear. And it's still taught.
I was telling my son, I was like, Smokey the Bear is racist. And I say stuff like kind of off the wall. But then when I started telling him, I'm like, Smokey the Bear and these policies that go along with it prevented people from this land from doing their cultural practices or cultural burn ceremonies, which prevented so many things in the ecosystem. Like, for example, camas root is a traditional food from this area, but it is difficult to dig out and to access without cultural burns. I was just in this presentation, somebody was talking about all of these hundreds of items that were dependent on fire, like acorns and baskets and sacred items, and none of it is going to be really accessible and available without fire. So not only, so you think about that. Yes, that is a racist practice to prevent people from practicing their culture and eating their traditional foods. And if you're not eating your traditional foods, then you're not fed physically, spiritually. You're not connecting to your community in the ways that are just built into like processing those foods and gathering those foods or those sacred items. So it's, when you think about it, there's so much more to it, right?
So what can us residents do to expand our knowledge regarding land back, language back, and culture back? And how can we go forward to help this effort?
I love that question. Thank you for asking. I think that there's like just having these types of conversations like we're having today, expanding your circle, disrupting systems like white supremacy and nationalism that have such deep roots. We pledge allegiance to the flag, like a flag, that's what we're pledging allegiance to. Like we can't pledge allegiance to each other and to our health and to the earth. Things like one nation, like we aren't one nation, we are many different nations. So like this continuing indigenous erasure and erasure of all the beautiful different cultures that are here. Disrupting the concept that, or the misconception that the military keeps us safe. It hasn't kept us safe. All the contamination and ecocide, I think is one of the like largest polluters is the military. And then you have that animal agriculture, I think, as a close second. So reconsidering what we're told about imperialism and creating safety within our community. So we keep us safe is like a quote that I think came from the Black Lives Matter movement. And then reconsidering whose opinions we value, uplifting voices that aren't typically the ones that would, we turn on the TV and we see usually it's a white man. So kind of going to the opposite from that, like maybe a queer Native youth or queer youth of color, just to expand perspectives as much as possible as part of decolonizing, like who we give our attention and value to. And supporting language revitalization is huge, and indigenous sovereignty. And then asking, do you have land? Does your family have land? Are you contributing to that ratio of like over 90 something percent of whites owning the land and controlling the land? So rematriating is kind of like getting the land back to the people that were put here to steward that land. And keep mentioning the Native women's share, who has like several different events coming up. If you're interested, I can share more about that. I have a quote here about what is rematriation. According to Stephen Newcomb from the Indigenous Law Institute, rematriation is restoring a living culture to its rightful place on Mother Earth. And to restore people to a spiritual way of life in sacred relationship with their ancestral lands without external interference. We also have the Klamath water issues. There's native suckerfish that are at risk because of water temperatures changing and land use. The ranchers are preventing this ancient traditional lifestyle because of their water extraction and their entitlement to this water. So newcomers coming here and really disrupting and changing the way that life has been for so long, which doesn't make any sense because, like we were talking about, it's just not sustainable. It's not going to work for anyone. So supporting those efforts, read books by natives, watch films by natives, decolonize your diet, stop supporting animal agriculture, which is so devastating. Like cows and pigs are not from here. So I don't think we should be eating those. They've been as harmful to the land as the people that brought them here. Divest from white supremacy, reevaluate your sources of information, who you are, who you hire, what you think you're entitled to, and reimagine. Like there's this quote that I would also like to read. It's, carcerality reduces people to objects in order to exercise control over and through them. This disciplined our behavior and our imagination. So that limits what we believe to be possible. So I really like to expand like what we think is possible. That's really exciting to me. So yeah, those are some things I think we can start to work on.
I think those are all really good recommendations, and I liked your quotes. So I think we're just going to wrap it up. Is there anything you want to talk about or add before we wrap things up?
Well, I just want to really thank you so much from the bottom of my heart that you were willing to have. Sometimes people could think this is a difficult conversation, and I understand that. So that was courageous of you to invite me here, and forgive me if there's anything I said that wasn't correct or that hurts anyone. And just reminding everybody that I'm just speaking from what I have gathered through my years, and it's not reflective of anyone else's opinion, and I'm not re representing anyone. So I would love to continue to have conversations with people if they're interested, and hopefully to collaborate and continue to do this work with others.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Living Downstream.